Welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported by Humanities Montana and the Greater Montana Foundation. I screwed up the intro already. The Right Question is supported by Humanities Montana and listeners like you, as well as the Greater Montana Foundation and a cooperative independent bookstores around the state. Fact and Fiction here in Missoula, Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Elk River Books in Livingston, and Montana Book Company in Helena. And as I said, we've always been supported by listeners just like those of you listening right now. I'm Lauren Korn. This is a special live spring pledge episode of The Right Question with Montana's current poet laureate, Chris Latray. Chris Latray is a Métis storyteller, a descendant of the Pembina Band of the mighty Red River of the North, and an enrolled member of the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians. He is the author of Becoming Little Shell, Returning Home to the Landless Indians of Montana, which will be published this summer, one-sentence journal, short poems and essays from the world at large, and Descended from a Travel-Worn Satchel. Chris also writes the weekly newsletter, An Irritable Métis, and lives near Frenchtown, Montana. He's the 2023 through 2025 Montana Poet Laureate. Chris, thanks for bearing with me through that long intro, and thank you so much for being here for our spring fundraiser. Welcome to The Right Question.
Well, miigwech. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's so glad to have you. To you and all of our listeners who celebrate, happy National Poetry Month to you.
Yeah, thank you.
How are you celebrating as Montana's current poet laureate? Is National Poetry Month different from any other month for you?
It's hard to know because I've only been poet laureate for 6 months, I guess. Well, I guess seven. Well,
we're going on eight, I think.
April's the 8th, yeah. So I was already busy, but I just get more panicked people saying, oh, we want the poet laureate to come to our school next week. Are you available? And it's like, well, maybe next year we can book it.
Are you booked that far out?
I'm booked pretty much through this year, and I'm starting to book into next year. So, yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, the combination of the book coming out and poet laureate, while it's great timing, but also it's just two layers of busyness sitting on top of each other.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So are you celebrating National Poetry Month with students across Montana?
I can't say I'm celebrating it more than I do any other month.
Sure.
You know, because that's what I've been doing since I was poet laureate is going in and talking to kids. And, you know, I do adult programs also, but yep. I just wrapped up a 12-week residency for the Missoula Writing Collaborative up in Ronan. Mm-hmm. And so that's just part of my life now. You know, it's something I never would have imagined even 10 years ago that so much of my efforts would be involved in teaching poetry to children when I don't really feel like I know what I'm talking about because I have my own ideas about what it is. And it's nice to be able to go out and share them. And as poet laureate, it gives me a certain gravitas to say, sure. Yeah, what I'm saying is right. Let the next guy tell me I was wrong, you know, or next person.
In preparing for this conversation, Chris, I've become really taken by the way that you talk about everything that poetry can be. So my first official question, I guess, it's second question, is both kind of a softball question and an enormous question. What is poetry to you?
Poetry is everything. Mm-hmm. So everything, if you view it the way I feel it should be viewed, or the best way to view it in my view is everything is poetry. And I tell students that the least important thing when it comes to poetry is what actually ends up on the page. And I relate it to Anishinaabe worldview. So as a Métis person, as a Little Shell member, Chippewa Cree, I am Anishinaabe. Mm-hmm. And in Anishinaabe worldview, if we practice living the way our seven grandfathers' teachings urge us to, mm-hmm. every footstep becomes a prayer. And I love that idea that every step on this earth becomes a prayer to the earth and everything around us. Poetry is the same way. So I came to poetry through spending a lot of time in the woods and on riverbanks and creeks and mountains and wetlands next to a convenience store, things like that, just mm-hmm. observing the world and paying attention to the change of the seasons and all of that. And that to me is poetry. And if you view the world like that, if you pay attention to the outer world and your inner world then that is poetry, and every step then becomes a poem. So I feel like the two are this thousands-year-old indigenous worldview is the same as the thousand-year-old tradition of poems. Mm-hmm. And the two, I feel like that is just a great way to relate them.
So then every moment can be viewed as a poem then. Is it difficult, at least as you've experienced your tenure now as poet laureate, is it difficult to break students, whether they're children or adults, of their preconceived notions about poetry, that it's, you know, this scholarly pursuit or one that, you know, requires difficult to be serious? Is it difficult to break that from people?
I think it's more difficult to break it in adults,
sure.
You know, because poetry, most people you talk to, they say they hate poetry. And that's because we've been teaching the same poems by the same dead white guys who lived 3,000 miles away 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's hard when you're a teenager anywhere. It's a rare individual who's going to relate to that. And I feel like poetry is something that's kind of had a bag thrown over its head and been dragged off to the ivory tower. And I want to, you know, round up a bunch of my rowdy poem writing friends and break that tower down and drag it back out. And you know, kids, I'll usually ask a room full, whether it's 10 or 200 or 500, how many of you are poets? And, you know, there's the weirdo like you or I were.
The timid one that raises their hands
like we were when we were in middle school or high school or whatever. And then I say, well, how many of you text? And everybody raises their hands. And I say, well, why do we text? And then we have a conversation about that. We express our joys in our life or our sorrows, or we might just tell our parents we love them or our significant other we love them. And we're doing things with texting that we typically do with poems also. And so I make the case that I feel like right now, because of texting, there are more actively practicing poets in the world than at any time in the history of people. And when I start talking about it like that, you can just kind of see lights going on in these teenagers, you know, like synapses are misfiring and sparking, you know, and you can see the change in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hope that some come out of those discussions realizing that texting isn't this horrible thing that adults think kids do too much of. It is a great way to express into the world, which is what poetry and any kind of art is the purpose of, expressing ourselves out into the world and finding people to share it with us.
We're talking to Montana's current poet laureate, Chris Latray. Chris is talking about texting. Well, all of you listeners out there with your cell phones in hands, now is the time. Go to mtpr.org. We're in the middle of a challenge right now. Michael, how many more pledges do we need to meet this challenge that will give us a $4,000 bump?
Just 22 more now. 22 more.
22 more pledges.
And here's the numbers. 406-243-6400, mtpr.org. 406-243-6400, mtpr.org.
That's incredible. And Chris, I am going to presume that you have been a public radio listener for a while. Is that a safe assumption to make?
It is a safe assumption to make, yes.
Where do you listen to public radio? Where does public radio live in your life?
You know, it lived very strongly in my life in my previous job when I would travel all over the country, and I'd always immediately find on the radio where the local NPR station was, because
sure.
It was always kind of in the, you know, 88 to 92 band on the FM dial.
Yeah.
And I loved going around the country and listening to stations in other parts of the country. And,
sure.
And so there was similarity, but then you also got the local stories. You know, like one year I was in Chicago one week where they were playing the Packers, and then the next week I was in Green Bay where they were playing the Bears. But again, you know, like back-to-back weeks, and just hearing the different perspectives was really fascinating, a part of their culture that is so different that we don't really have out here.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a way to kind of connect with familiarity to a different place, if that makes sense.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you're listening right now and maybe you're not a Montanan, or maybe you're on the road traveling between your job and home, now is the time to donate. 406-243-6400-mtpr.org. If you are in your car, do be safe. Pull over to the side of the road, please. 406-243-6400-mtpr.org.
I can happily say 19 pledges to go.
We're well on our way. This challenge ends at 8:30 after A New Angle airs, and that's following the right question. Now is the time, listeners. 406-243-6400-mtpr.org. Chris, you wrote in a recent issue of State of the Arts, which is it's a periodical put out by the Montana Arts Council, that, quote, "I feel it's my responsibility as poet laureate to be out there as an ambassador, not just of the art of words, but the pursuit and practice and urging on of every single individual's expression of creativity." You kind of touched on that before we went into that break about it's not just about poetry. You want to encourage everyone to lean into art. Talk more about that.
Well, you know, everybody's trying to like have side gigs that somehow make them money, right? And sure. and there are certain elements of our culture who suggest that if you're doing something and you're not making money, it's not worth doing. And creativity is at its best when you don't care about what the result of it is. And that's how I started writing poetry. It was something that I never figured I would ever really have as anything other than just this secret little habit that I kept to myself. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started sharing that it kind of began to flourish a little bit. And I still have that relationship to it. But, you know, like we were talking earlier, my rock band's playing a show tonight.
Yeah.
And I consider my career, that's air quotes, in playing in rock bands, the most successful undertaking of my life.
Well, then maybe I'm interrupting you too soon here. How do you define success?
Well, that's just it. By every measure of success, economic, whatever, it's an absolute failure. But for doing it just because I love it. You know, when I bought my first record in 1977, it was Kiss Love Gun. Uh-huh. I decided that I was going to be a rock star and I was going to write books on the side. And from 1983, when my friends and I put together our first rock band, from 1983 till right now, those 40 whatever years it is, there's probably been a year cumulative that I wasn't in a rock band.
Wow.
And the guys I'm playing with now, we've been together for 20 years. And we love it. It's something I do simply because I love it. And I tell students that also, that the things that they love now when you're 10 or 12 or 15 or 16 are the things that you're going to love when you're gray. And as I heard somebody else say earlier, his gray hairs are starting to fall out. When you're old, we love these things. We're still the same people. And there's nothing I love more than getting up on stage and melting people's faces. I love it as much now at 50 whatever I am as I did when I was 22.
Do those impulses overlap for you, this idea, these creative impulses of poetry or writing and being in a rock band? Is there anything that overlaps in maybe the feeling that you're getting in your body or the messages that you're trying to convey to your listeners or your audience?
Joy is the overlap.
Joy.
So joy and then just the connection. So both playing music, whether it's people just sweating and bashing their bodies against each other is wonderful. But also, you know, there are times I'm in a room full of people and I can feel that we are all like right on the edge of bursting into tears, because I'm constantly on the edge of bursting into tears. And you can feel that. And it is that connection, that ritual. It's a ritual. Mm. Creativity and sharing it and expressing it with each other is ritual. It's not meant to be shared in the darkness of our own homes, watching Netflix or playing a video game. And yeah, there's a place for that. But movie theaters and live music and poetry readings and whatever it is that you do, you know, going out dancing or skating or playing ultimate frisbee or whatever, all of these communal things we do, there is a joy and a ritualization of our shared humanity and our shared connection to everything around us that only happens when we get together like that.
Has becoming the Poet Laureate changed the way that you think about or that you perceive community in this state?
I don't know.
Maybe strengthened it or just affirmed it?
I was already doing so many things similar to what I do as Poet Laureate before I became Poet Laureate, which is why I think I was selected as Poet Laureate. Certainly not because I'm anywhere near the best poet in Montana, which people have that perspective of. It's not. I just think, you know, I'm good at ritualizing groups of people.
And building community.
I don't really think about it like that, but that's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You spoke or you touched on this idea of making art as business, right? And Montana actually has a really robust artistic community, artists in the state that make money off of their art. And because we're, you know, doing this, we're chatting in the middle of this spring fundraiser, I do kind of want to touch on this idea of art and money or art and the economy. You write in one sentence journal, Chris, quote, "What will run out first, the year or the money?" And you gave up something. You kind of touched on this. You gave up something like a corporate job or like a technical writing job for the life of a creative writer. I'm curious what you might say to our listeners about the life of a working artist. That is not a very specific question, but can you speak to that idea?
Yeah, it's tenuous. You know, for example, the foundation of my income right now is the newsletter I write. Where people can pay to subscribe to it, and they don't have to. People just choose to, and you know that's tech. And as tech goes, it could collapse any day. And there goes 40% of my income,
right.
You know, so it's tenuous. Living, you know, an artistic life is tenuous because, you know, trends change, you know, people's, you know, ability to spend money changes, you know, and you're kind of on the edge of that. But I would rather the Cree had a word for the Métis that was Ipamenisawak. Uh-huh. Ipamenisawak, and that means the people who own themselves.
Yes.
And my old job, when I left that, I just decided no one is ever going to tell me what to do again, and I don't care if I have to live in my car to do it. I just am going to dedicate myself to this thing that I've been passionate about my entire life. And I own myself. There's nothing I do that I can't just say, no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, right now, if you asked me to say something on air that I'm not comfortable with, I'd say,
no,
thanks, but yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah, no. Yeah, I hope that wouldn't happen.
Yes. I'm here because I know it wouldn't. So, you know, you get to pick the people you spend time with, which brings us back to public radio.
Absolutely.
Who do you want to spend time with? People who are here out of the love for it and the need for arts and news and the types of programs that when you attach a dollar sign to maybe don't make a lot of money, but people need them in their lives.
Yeah.
And you know, the special characters that are part of our community that exist because of public radio, it's a critical part of our community, as we keep bringing up.
Well, Chris, I think you did it. I think you bridged this strange gap between poetry and money, in a way,
economy. I hate money.
But it's necessary, right? Unfortunately, that's where we're living.
Only because we are allowing it to be. So it's a long game. But if we decided that living was more important than making money, we could change it. Because that's how we did it for thousands of years.
Yeah.
Trade and commerce is not capitalism. And we could bring it back. There's so many things that we did on this continent for thousands of years and lived good lives that we could bring back in bits and pieces. And that's what I care about.
I care about that too. Until that time, though, listeners.
I know, I'm sorry.
Until that time comes, listeners, we are asking you to help support this vital public service of people doing what they love. I love my job. I love that I get to be sitting across from you tonight, Chris, talking about poetry and rock and roll and even a little bit of money. I love that you're here with me this evening. Listeners, we know that you care about poetry and Chris Latray, and you care about this vital public service that we are providing you. Now is the time to donate. We are still in the middle of a challenge. It's lasting until 8:30 this evening after a new angle. We need that $4,000 bump. Michael, where are we in pledge numbers
now
here?
Now just 17 more pledges
17.
To go.
17, that's a good number.
That's right, in about 70 minutes.
70 minutes, 17. I cannot do the math about how many pledges we need each minute of those 70 minutes.
About four.
There you go.
Okay, there we go.
Here's the phone numbers to call in this wonderful conversation tonight. It's 406-243-6400. It seems like quite a few people have been responding online.
Great.
Listening to your wonderful conversation, the two of you. And that's mtpr.org. mtpr.org. Make your pledge now. 17 more pledges, and there's a $4,000 bonus coming to us. But we have to get it by 8:30 p.m., 406-243-6400.
Thanks so much to those of you who have already donated this evening. Chris, I would be remiss if, you know, we were on this station that, you know, has thousands of listeners at any given moment. And, you know, you mentioned your newsletter, An Irritable Métis. That's a Substack newsletter. You also mentioned your rock band. Tell me a little bit about your rock band. And you said you're headed out tonight to play. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the other university station, KBGA, sponsored this show tonight because the KIO powwow starts this weekend. Uh-huh. And they wanted to do a show featuring indigenous or indigenous-fronted bands.
Amazing.
And I guess because I'm indigenous and I'm kind of the front man of my band, American Falcon.
Yes.
They asked if we would do it. And of course, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm going to do every time we're asked to do it. So
yeah.
It's at the VFW, starts 20 minutes ago. We go on like at 9:15, I think.
Okay.
And we are really loud and the VFW is small and it's a punishing experience for people. But, you know, we suffer to prove our dedication. That's why we do sweat lodges. We suffer to prove our dedication to the spirit world.
Uh-huh.
So come to the VFW and suffer to prove your dedication to rock.
And just to bring it all around and to experience some joy in perhaps
joy.
An unexpected
Absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's, you know, from an indigenous perspective, we're not a political band. You know, that's the 180-degree separation between what I write as a poet and my songwriting. They're all like little stories about aliens and spaceships and monsters and stuff. And, you know, sometimes the best form of you know, resistance is joy. You know,
I love that.
Especially for indigenous people, you know, we live lives under occupation 24/7. So how, yes, sometimes it's great to do everything you can to stick it to the man, but sometimes it's great to just go out there and show the world that we're still capable of having a lot of fun. And we do a good job of that.
And that show sounds like it's going to
be. It will be.
A
I'm
lot
looking
of fun.
Forward to it.
Chris, I want to turn towards your memoir. This is a book that is coming out in August. So listeners, you can't quite get it, but you have a lot to look forward to.
You can pre-order it at any one of those wonderful independent bookstores that you mentioned on the lead-in.
Oh, you know what? And now's a good time. I want to make sure that I mention these bookstores again, just because they are supporting The Right Question this season, and I so appreciate their support, the community that they're building, the communities that they're building. The Right Question this season is supported by Fact and Fiction here in Missoula, Montana. Warm-hearted reference for both you and
Absolutely,
me, Chris.
Absolutely, yes.
Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Elk River Books in Livingston, and Montana Book Company in Helena.
Mm-hmm. So Fact and Fiction, I'm sorry, Michael.
I just wanted to jump in and give the phone numbers one more time.
Oh, yeah.
A brief update since you're at that wonderful moment here.
Sure, let's do it.
Now just 14.
14?
14.
Oh, we're getting there. Listeners, we know you're out there. Now is the time.
We're at the number of probably how many people will be at the show tonight. That's a powerful number.
It is.
It's a powerful number. I like it.
Here's the powerful number for you to call, 406-243-6400. If you do get a busy signal, please call back, 406-243-6400, mtpr.org.
Yeah, and while you're online, you can certainly go and look at many of the wonderful pledge gifts that we are offering. This is all in collaboration between donors, partnerships with community members. Now is the time to donate. mtpr.org, 406-243-6400. Okay, Chris, so I'm going to go back to this memoir. I thought that this conversation that we'd have here tonight, it kind of a chance to give listeners a sneak peek into this new memoir. I get the sneak peek, and I'm going to give them a sneak peek.
Because we're going to do the legit right question.
We're going to do not that this isn't legit.
Well, you know what I mean?
Yes, we're going to do a recorded.
The pre-recorded.
Yes, edited version. and yes, really dive into it. But I did want to give listeners a sneak peek. It's titled, and you're going to correct me, but I'm going to say the full title anyway. Your memoir, the advanced copy that I have, is titled Becoming Little Shell, Returning Home to the Landless Indians of Montana. And this is a big question already, but let's break that title down. Maybe you want to speak to the title first, but who are the Little Shell and what do you mean by landless?
So the Little Shell were known as the Landless Indians for more than 150 years. And that goes back to the creation of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation in North Dakota, which previous to that, you know, you mentioned in my introduction that I'm a descendant of the Pembina Band. We were all the Pembina Band of Chippewa.
Okay.
And when the feds came to grab our land, we became Turtle Mountain, and a bunch of us were disenrolled through that kind of dubious interaction. And we became landless. We became a diaspora spread across Montana, North Dakota. And, you know, when the Rocky Boy Reservation was created in 1916, the idea then was that all of the landless people who were in Montana at that time would be placed on that reservation, but it wasn't big enough. So the simplest answer for who are the Little Shell, you could say that, you know, where everybody who didn't fit on Rocky Boy at the time. That's a very simplified answer, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously it's bigger and far more complex than that.
Your memoir begins in a place where you decide to investigate your lineage, Chris. Mm-hmm. How long were you I don't even want to call it a research process because that sounds a little cold. This was much more, I don't know, it was a personal journey for you. How long were you, I'm going to just say it, researching this lineage from the point which you decided, I want to know who I am, to the point where this memoir is going to be published in August? What's that time span?
So from the time that I first voiced that I wanted to do it, it was 2013, so 11 years.
Yeah.
You know, and there were fits and starts and, you know, it really picked up steam in 2018 when I first presented the idea to an editor from Milkweed Editions.
Yeah.
And then the following year I gave them a proposal and that's when they said, yeah, we want to publish this book. So it was really 2017 that I really dug in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were fits and starts and little bits in there and a lot of self-doubt and all of those things that creates the momentum necessary to write a book like this, you know?
An Irritable Métis, as I understand it, was a newsletter that was supposed to be in service or written in service. And I say supposed to. This was something that you wanted.
Yeah.
You were going to write it in service of this larger investigation, this larger book, right?
Yeah, because I, you know, the first post on my Irritable Métis newsletter was just a couple weeks after we got federal recognition in December of 2019. Mm-hmm. And I was full of all these feelings about what did that mean. And that was kind of the happy ending.
Yeah.
You know, because when I started the book, we still weren't federally recognized. And mm-hmm. we were one vote shy in 2018 of getting it. And we were so close, but it felt inevitable. So when we got it in 2019, I felt, okay, my happy ending is complete. Now I just need to fill in all of this stuff.
This is kind of a broad question. You said fill in all of this stuff. What did that mean to you? What were you filling in?
Well, I'm kind of a armchair history geek. So I wanted to learn all this stuff that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the Métis? You know, where did we really come from? Why are so many people from my dad's generation in denial of their indigenous heritage? What is lateral violence? The generational trauma, all of these things that you hear about, but you know, you start investigating and you find all the ways that it lives in you. And I experience some of that every day.
Sure.
You know, driving over here, I had an experience. And that's probably why I'm a little spicy talking about capitalism and stuff.
I don't know, Chris. I think you're
hangry. So
I think you're at your best when you're spicy. So
yeah, I mean, I just care about it so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm really passionate about it. And that's, you know, how do you take all of this and make it readable for people who maybe aren't as interested in the minutiae as I am? And that was the challenge.
Sure. So as I read your memoir, Chris, I was really struck by the way that you've written about, and this is speaking to this idea of land or landlessness. I was really struck by the way that you write about and towards orientation. You seem to really want your readers to understand the space that you're in, the land that you're on, the geographies that you're writing about and from. And even your table of contents is a list of towns in Montana and even one in Canada. And those who know you, or even those who have maybe followed your career, know that traveling, you mentioned this previous job, that traveling is really important to you, to be on the road. And it occurred to me as I was reading your memoir, Chris, that, I don't know, that being on the road usually means being between one place and another, and that sometimes, and not always, but there's usually a destination. And in that way, the movement of your book, the becoming and the returning, feels so much in line with the comfort that I am reading you on the road. Does that reading scan for you?
Yeah, but part of it is whose definition of home are we going to use?
Okay.
So that's part of what caused us to be landless, is for thousands of years we lived as people that home was where we were at that moment, because we were constantly chasing buffalo and bringing it back and trading. And you know, that's part of the conflict between colonial power and indigenous power, is the different view of what it means to be part of a land. And I'm as much at home here as I am on the plains of North Dakota. And, you know, the returning is like returning to my cultural heritage. And it also carries a meaning of, for the Little Shell, returning to who we are as a people, that we've never not been that, but there's just been kind of a shroud over that. And our federal recognition is part of helping people understand that the wider world recognizes who we've always known we were, you know? And, you know, that's part of the whole land back thing that you hear about in Indigenous. It's not about kicking people off. It's reintegrating our relationship to the land as something we are part of, not something that it's separate from us. And I, you know, I recognized, you know, even the things that I was doing that made me become, or made people start calling me a poet with one sentence journal, you know, when I was dealing with grief, the loss of my father and a beloved pet I had, and the stress I was having with my old job, and how returning to the land and reconnecting to it was the land, like saying, I am where you will find your salvation. And I heard it without knowing I heard it. And it wasn't until later that I evolved more back into this person that I should have been all along, that I recognized it for what it was. And I think many of us have that in common. You know, we are all just 10 minutes evolutionarily removed from who we were when we first started sitting around a fire and telling stories to each other.
Yeah.
And we feel that lack. And some of us are just farther along in recognizing it than others. And I think it's artists, our role is to remind people of where we come from.
At the end of your memoir, Chris, you write, quote, "To call my father's death a catalyst, that is, a catalyst for writing this book, for exploring your lineage, would be a disservice to the enormity of it, but it's the best word I have." You've mentioned your father a couple of times now, Chris. Tell me about your dad. How are you most like him?
Stubborn and, you know, but also I think he was very, he loved the world too. And I think his efforts, my mom tells me that he always said that his only concern as a father was to not be a bad father like his was. And I think he achieved that, because he, for all of his conflicts and struggles, he was a good father to my, as best as he could. And I think it's complicated and complex. And, sure. You know, there are times when I hear words come out of my mouth or I react to something and I'm not happy with how I react. And I'm brought up to a specific memory of my dad doing the exact same thing. So, you know, we're all living these lives of trying to overcome that stuff that we've carried in us that we didn't even experience in the first place. Mm-hmm. And why was he like that? Why did he deny his indigenous heritage? You know, that's something I'm going to be reckoning with my entire life and just trying to make it easier for the next person to come along and not have to experience it to the depth that I have, you know?
And I don't know that there is an answer to this question or that it's a question, it's not a drafted question, but your father, he denied his indigenous heritage. You sort of went in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
You have completely embraced your indigeneity. Where's that separation for him and you? Like, where was it in seeing how vehemently he was opposing his indigeneity that you're like, no, this is something that I'm going to grab a hold of? Is that just a child's want to oppose their parent? What is that?
I always identified as Chippewa because I was told, you know, by my grandmother that that's what we were. And, you know, when you're young, there's just this, okay, dad says this, grandma says this. She's his mom, so she's probably right. You know, all these weird yeah. justifications you make as a kid. And as I got older, you know, I started to learn a little bit more just because if you're halfway attentive, at least where we live, you see these conflicts between indigenous people and settler people.
Sure.
So it just started to just churn more and more in me as I got older. And, you know, now I recognize why he was the way he was, because he grew up at a time when, like in central Montana, there were still signs in stores that said no breeds allowed, no half breeds allowed. Mm. So he was in a position where it was self-defense for him to deny who he was. I don't have that. I'm not at risk generally of violence for me proclaiming my indigeneity. And it's the responsibility of my generation and subsequent ones to stand up for who we are, because the people before us could not.
Yeah.
They sacrificed so that we could be who we are.
You are listening to Montana's current poet laureate, Chris Latray. You are listening to a live Spring Pledge edition of The Right Question. I'm Lauren Korn. We are in the middle of a challenge. We're heading straight towards it. Last time we checked, there was 14 pledges left. Michael, where are we now?
Now just 11 more.
11 pledges.
11
okay.
pledges, and listeners, we will have a $4,000 bonus.
Yeah, listeners, we know you're out there. Now is the time to call. I know that maybe you are attentively listening to Chris because what he is saying is so fascinating and interesting and so heartfelt. We don't mind the phone ringing behind us. So we hope that that's what happens. 406-243-6400-mtpr.org.
It seems like quite a few people are pledging online and listening at home.
That's great.
I think.
And we're hearing the phone now. That's
thank
great.
You so much.
Thank you so much for your support.
Just
thank
11
you.
More in about 50 minutes.
Yeah. And thank you so much for your support of storytelling. Chris, you mentioned storytelling being such an important part of your life, of your lineage. That is something that obviously I really, really love to bring out of my featured guests. And that's something that I support. That's something you, our listeners, support as well. 406-243-6400-mtpr.org. Chris, I want to talk a little bit more about your dad. You write in your memoir that Missoula was your father's heart center and that it's your heart center too. Talk about what you mean when you write heart center. What does that mean? What's that feeling that this place evokes in you?
Wherever I go, I always come back here, you know? And so I've left and come back. And when I say Missoula, I kind of mean the whole valley.
Because
I grew up, you know, in, well, Frenchtown, but technically 6 Mile, which is up above Houston. So I'm using words very broadly when I say where I'm from. I say where I live in Frenchtown now, just because that's where the kids in my neighborhood go to school, even though it's a Missoula address.
Sure.
And I like to say Frenchtown because who needs another Missoula writer, right? So so when I fill out a bio, I can say I'm from Frenchtown and people are like, ooh, where's that? That sounds exotic.
Doesn't it though?
It really does. And but But yeah, it's just a place where it's beautiful. And so many people come here and they just cobble together a life so that they can stay here. And that's what I've been doing, you know, just cobbling together a life so I can stay here. So I can pick, well, what river do I want to be on today? Mm. You know, what peak do I want to be on top of today? What drainage, what forest do I want to wander around in that I can be to any number of, you know, within 30 minutes or an hour. And we are so fortunate for that. And
I was just going to say, what a privilege it is to live in this place.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Chris, I'm going to pivot a little bit. Your Métis great-great-grandfather served as an interpreter for the U.S. Army and spoke at least 6 languages. You have shouted out a couple of Ojibwe words in our conversation, and language revitalization is front of mind for many tribes here in Montana mm-hmm. and in this country. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your great-great-grandfather, but I'd also like to hear about the language revitalization work that you're seeing in this realm as you travel around the state.
So that's actually a hallmark of Métis people, is that we were multilingual.
Yeah.
You know, because we were this mix of European and indigenous heritage. So that was just one of the things we did. We were interpreters, we were guides, and all of these things. So that's like part of our culture was multilingual people, not just men, but the whole community was.
Uh-huh.
You know, so the Little Shell chose Anishinaabe Mohan or Ojibwe Mohan or Chippewa, whatever you want to call the language, as our official language. And we don't have in Montana our last fluent first language, which means that's the language they were born into, mm-hmm. died of COVID.
Wow.
So we don't have any first language fluent Ojibwe speakers left in Montana.
What
so,
a loss.
So, you know, we have to devote resources to that. And, you know, there are a few in language immersion schools on the reservations. You know, there's a, you know, on Fort Belknap and on the CSKT reservation and so and Browning on the Blackfeet reservation. So there's some going on, but that is critical.
Yeah.
Language preservation, revitalization is probably the most important thing we can be doing as tribes today. And, you know, I'm fortunate to know people. My friend Anna East works for the Montana Digital Academy, which is like the state's online school. And her job is devoted to working with each tribe in Montana to devote online language learning programs for their students.
Wow. What a service.
It's huge. It's and it's a long game. You know, it takes a long time, and you have to build relationships that can take years. So we can't expect it's anything that's going to turn around. But little bit by bit, you learn one word, you learn 5 words. That's 5 more than you knew yesterday, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 11 recognized languages in Montana, unless you include Michif, which is the Métis language, which I think you should. And the only reason it isn't is because the United States doesn't recognize the Métis.
The Métis.
And then sign language, which is probably by far the most important language in the history of this region. Because that's how all the Plains tribes, everybody from Texas all the way up into what is, you know, Manitoba and Saskatchewan, that's how we communicated, was through sign language.
Wow, yeah.
And the relationships we built for millennia because of that language. I would really love to see an effort made to make that, revitalize that even more too.
Chris, there is so much more we can and will talk about in the future about this memoir, Becoming Little Shell. First, I want to congratulate you on its imminent release. It's big, it's huge. So many congratulations. Is there anything you want our listeners to know before we hand things over to Justin Engel tonight?
Lauren, I would say we have been friends for such a long time, and we have both evolved in what we do in the world, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here doing this with you, doing my part to help raise money for this critical
public service
of our national community.
Absolutely.
And I am so appreciative. Chimi Gwech, thank you very much for asking me to do this.
Oh, it's my privilege, my pleasure, Chris. You're making it big. You're doing so much, and it is a joy. It is my joy to see you succeed in this way, and your writing is beautiful. This memoir is beautiful. Listeners, as I said, Chris and I will we'll devote an entire Right Question episode, pre-recorded, edited, and it'll be coming down the pipeline later this year. You've been listening to a live episode of The Right Question. I'm Lauren Korn. Joining me today was Chris Latray, current Montana Poet Laureate. This season, The Right Question was supported by Humanities Montana, the Greater Montana Foundation, and a cooperative of independent bookstores around the state. Fact and Fiction here in Missoula, Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Elk River Books in Livingston, and Montana Book Company in Helena. We've always been supported, always been supported by listeners just like you right now. My team and I couldn't do what we do without the support of our community partners and you, our listeners. I also want to give a quick shout out to my team, Chris Moyles, Jake Birch occasionally, and Aiden McMahon, who just said his goodbyes to Montana Public Radio. So thank you to everyone who makes The Right Question possible.
So nice to have you here, Chris. Thank you so much. And Lauren, it was delightful 45 minutes there.
I hope so. Just yeah, I was enamored by what Chris was saying.
Indeed.
For sure.
Now, just 10 more pledges to go.
Oh, we can do this. We've got more, what? We've got
45 minutes, 10 pledges.
Okay, we can do this. And I know Justin Engel is good about talking about the importance of public radio and media, too.
And he's got Corn Cates Carney on the program tonight, too.
Well, it's just a family affair tonight,
it
huh?
It is, indeed.
Perfect. MTPR.org is the website to go to. There you can look at all the pledge gifts. 406-243-6400 is the phone number to call. We have volunteers at the ready.
We have a $4,000 bonus added to the tally from a listener in Kalispell when we receive now 10 more pledges. 406-243-6400, mtpr.org.